Thank you for inviting me. I've never been to Perimeter. It's quite a place you have here. To launch right into this, so I should start off by saying, so I'm a lattice gauge theorist by training. So my sort of day job is doing precision lattice QCD calculations, you know, standard model, form factors, and so forth. But I think it's an interesting question, and sort of following in the footsteps of people like Jan and Renate and others, like Jan Smit, Simon Catterall from, well, back in the day. I wanted to try and start my own sort of in my spare time, as it were, to try and understand whether one can put gravity on the lattice using methods similar to or the same as what was done or attempted 20 years ago. So that's sort of the motivation and sort of where I'm coming from. So this talk was. I've given a variant of this talk to lattice gauge theorists, and they need much more introduction usually to quantum gravity. But since I'm not so familiar with this group, I'm just going to give you my spiel, and I'll try not to belabor too many of these points. Okay, so. The first line here, of course, quantum gravity is one of the outstanding problems in theoretical physics. What, as I see it, are the outstanding problems? Well, we know that a straightforward implementation as a perturbative quantum field theory is not renormalizable. And it's been explicitly confirmed that a counter term is necessary at two-loop order in pure gravity and one loop for gravity plus matter. However, it still makes sense. You can think of this as an effective field theory at low energies, but of course, introducing new couplings at each order in perturbation theory leads to a loss of predictive power. And I say this is just like chiral perturbation theory for lattice gauge theorists who are much more familiar with chiral perturbation theory than with quantum gravity as a low energy effective theory. Okay, but here, you know, I mean, this is you guys. This is your bread and butter. And then, of course, there's the effective field theory argument that suggests that the cosmological constant should be 120 orders of magnitude larger than observed. You know, sort of the most naive. I should use this. Okay. So what is asymptotic safety? So Weinberg proposed way back when that gravity might be asymptotically safe. And what this basically entails is that gravity would be effectively renormalizable when formulated non-perturbatively. And another way of saying this is that the problem could lie with perturbation theory, that you could that perturbation theory might break down, and say if there's a strongly coupled fixed point in the UV, perturbation theory might give you misleading results. So maybe general relativity is renormalizable after all, it's just perturbation theory breaks down. So in this case, so under this condition, so basically the condition of asymptotic safety, the renormalization group flow of couplings has a non-trivial fixed point with a finite dimensional ultraviolet critical surface. Okay, if it was infinite dimensional, then you're in the same undesirable scenario that you need an infinite number of couplings, except it's non-perturbative, but basically it's the same problem. So you want this thing to be finite, the dimension of the ultraviolet critical surface, and preferably small, because the dimension of this ultraviolet critical surface is the number of parameters that you would need to fix from experiment. Okay, and in a lattice formulation, or in particular in a Euclidean lattice formulation, the fixed point would show up as a second order critical point, the approach to which would define a continuum limit. So this becomes sort of putting some actions on the lattice, or defining what you mean by the lattice, doing a sum over states, evaluating the Feynman path integral of your latticized theory, putting different terms in your action or whatever, and adjusting them and searching the phase diagram to see if you can find what sorts of phase transitions you can find. Okay, and so this has a long history. I'm just going to mention some of the highlights. So what's come to be called Euclidean dynamical triangulations is a lattice formulation that was introduced in the 90s. Okay, here, these are some names associated with it, at least the review of what this is. The idea is that lattice geometries are approximated by triangles with fixed edge lengths. So this is as opposed to Reggie calculus, where the edge lengths are allowed to vary. This is sort of a fixed edge length Reggie calculus, if you will. The dynamics is contained in the connectivity of the triangles, which can be added or deleted. So the connectivity of this thing changes, the size and the shape of the lattice changes. So to lattice QCD people with a fixed hypercubic lattice with the fields living on the links and on the nodes, you know, you think of in Monte Carlo space, you're sampling configurations of different fields. Here, the lattice is the dynamical entity. And in fact, you can fix the dimension. So the question is, what is the dimension of the geometry that you're simulating? The point is that you can fix the dimension of your building blocks, but the emergent dimension of the geometries that you get out is not necessarily tied to the dimension of the building blocks, or it's not necessarily the same. Okay, so the one reason to maybe start with, say, EDT rather than, say, Reggie calculus is that EDT appears to work perfectly in two dimensions, where it reproduces the results of non-critical bosonic string theory. And other approaches like matrix models, which sort of basically the continuum approaches and the lattice approach agree for everything that's been compared, to the best of my knowledge, in two dimensions. So then, you know, back in the sort of early 90s, people were excited about that, and so they moved on to four dimensions, and they said, okay, so let's look at four dimensions. But there it was shown that the formulation has two phases, one of which has been called the crumpled phase, or sometimes called the collapsed phase, depending on which paper you read on whatever day. So the crumpled phase has a very large or perhaps infinite Hausdorff dimension. Okay, so the Hausdorff dimension is a fractal dimension defined by geometries, sort of the scaling of geometries. Basically comparing the surface area of a sphere to its radius is one way to define a Hausdorff dimension. Another fractal dimension that I'll mention is the spectral dimension, which is defined via a diffusion process. The point is that the Hausdorff dimension in this crumpled phase has a very large Hausdorff, is very large. And then there's another phase which is called the branched polymer phase. So this looks sort of like this stringy, sort of, if you imagine this sort of spaghetti-like phase with Hausdorff dimension 2. And then the critical point separating them was shown to be first order, so that no new continuum physics is expected, right? So the name of the game is to find diverging correlation lengths so that you can take the lattice spacing to zero while leaving physical quantities unchanged. And so in order to do that, things have to be very large on the scale, physical things have to be very large on the scale of a single lattice spacing. So you need divergent correlation lengths. That means you need a second order phase transition. So pretty clear evidence was found that this was a first order phase transition, and some recent resurgence in this topic has confirmed that the phase transition is first order. So then that doesn't look so promising. Now, maybe I should stop for just a second, not stop, but mention, so there's causal, so Ambjorn, Lull, and collaborators introduced this causal dynamical triangulations, which since I see them in the audience, I suspect most of you are familiar with this. But I'll give you a quick recap, just in case you're not. The idea here was to introduce a foliation into the geometries. Okay, so in some sense, the geometries are less wild, so the topology is fixed. So in their case, most of the simulations that they've done have been R cross S3, and with a fixed foliation. And in that case, they actually saw four-dimensional looking geometries that resemble Euclidean de Sitter space. Okay, so it looks like you can actually formulate a lattice theory that reproduces at least the right global degrees of, gets the global degrees of freedom right, that sort of matches on to classical or semi-classical general relativity. Yes.
Slightly correct you.
Yes.
Formulations of causal structure, not ones that last for
formulation. Right. Yes.
That's right.
So the original work had the had a foliation, but then there's also attempts to go beyond this that has just the causal.
Just the original
motivation. Okay.
Just to make the causal Lorentzian theory instead of the that's the main physical
motivation. Yes. Yes. And this formulation also has this nice property that you have a positive definite transfer matrix, so you can show unitarity, at least at the level of the lattice theory. So it has very nice features. I mean, I guess my motivation was, well, you know, so there are the RG people, the renormalization group people who would claim that there's a fixed point, right? So this is using exact renormalization group equations. I don't know if there's anybody in this room that works on that. Is there anybody here that, okay. So the idea there is basically to formulate the renormalization group equations to include it, which in principle includes an infinite set of operators, and then to sort of integrate out high energy degrees of freedom and follow the RG flow of this infinite number of couplings. Now in practice, they have to truncate this, the number of couplings, and it's not clear that this truncation can be done. I mean, one can do lots of different types of truncations, but it's not like perturbation theory, where you know that the thing that you left out is small, and you can bound it by knowing the value of some coupling, so, you know, in some weak coupling expansion. So, you know, despite the fact that they've seen seen the fixed point in many, many different types of truncations, you always wonder, is there something that's being left out? And so that's why you would like to have a lattice formulation, because at least in principle, you can do controlled calculations. You know, if you get close enough to the fixed point, presumably one can introduce some kind of semantic effective theory and take a continuum limit with bounded discretization effects and that type of thing. So that's sort of well defined in QCD. Of course, QCD, you have perturbation theory to guide you at high energies because QCD is asymptotically free. Here, you're sort of, the hope is that it's asymptotically safe, but it could be strongly coupled at the in the UV. Okay, so so what's interesting is that sort of even independent of trying to introduce some kind of foliation or some sort of time slicing or causal condition in their in the RG formulation, they do seem to see sort of fixed point behavior just in generic Euclidean space-time. And so the question is, well, if they really are seeing this fixed point, why doesn't dynamical triangulations work without the causal structure? Of course, it could be the Wick rotation. Now, these guys seem to, I mean, they work in Euclidean space, the RG people, and so, you know, maybe, and they find the fixed point. So you wonder, maybe there should be this, you know, why don't we see evidence for such a fixed point? And in fact, if you go back to the continuum formulation, I mean, there's just R squared gravity, even though there could be problems with unitarity, the so-called ghost poles in R squared gravity, it is, it can be shown to be power counting renormalizable. Basically, you pick up a power of 1 over k to the fourth in the graviton propagator. So you would think that you would at least see something like that. Of course, maybe you have to add an R squared term. So it looks like there are things that one could maybe do to test the lore, the continuum lore of quantum gravity, you know, of asymptotic safety and renormalizability. Sort of independent of a truncation, to see what happens if you can do something without the causality condition.
Right. Of course, we are testing R squared term.
Yes.
But that's, of course, the formalism is not so well suited for doing it in a simple.
Yes.
So, in this sense, it was inconclusive.
Yes. So now I'm going to move on to sort of a quick review of the formalism. I'll show you some numerical results, and I'm also going to discuss a little bit of my overarching picture, which may or may not be right, but which is sort of, you know, there's some evidence that it could be correct, but just sort of, and in fact, the picture developed before the numerics, so there might be, at least from my reference frame, it looks like the causality happened in the right order. In other words, trying to understand what's going on. But I'll tell you what I found, and you can decide for yourself. So the continuum, this is just sort of a schematic of the continuum, Euclidean path integral, just the partition function here. Again, this is just schematic. This is the Einstein-Hilbert action with the cosmological constant term, which you guys all know. This is the discrete Euclidean Regi action, which you may also all know. But in case you don't, here it is. So delta is just this deficit angle. So this is just the difference between, you know, this is just a measure of the curvature. So this is just the Regi term, the Einstein-Hilbert term, and this is the cosmological constant term. And so, you know, since these are triangles rather than hypercubes, instead of having ones everywhere, you get things like root 5 over 96. But, you know, for the purposes of the simulations, you can just absorb these into constants. Okay, so kappa 2 and kappa 4 are related to the bare Newton's constant and the bare cosmological constant, and you can do the algebra and figure out what that relationship is. But these are the things that one enters into the code in order to run the simulations and to explore the phase diagram. Now, kappa 4 has to be tuned in order to take the infinite volume limit, at least the infinite lattice volume limit. And so that leaves kappa 2 as a parameter to be adjusted, okay, in order to explore the phase diagram. Now, continuum calculations suggest a form for the measure that there's some product over all space with some root determinant g to the beta. Now, you get exactly a term like this, say, if you wanted to do non-relativistic quantum mechanics in spherical coordinates, right? You'd get a term like this with beta equal to 1, okay? So it's, I mean, this is sort of a generic thing in path integrals, and if you have perhaps curved space-time, you might expect something like this. Now, this is an ultra-local measure term, so you might wonder, well, should this really change continuum behavior? But, one can put it in the simulations and see what happens. I mean, it's possible maybe to interpret this as a sum of higher order, higher curvature terms. People have sort of looked at it that way. It looks like it's pretty straightforwardly, a product over the sort of local volume of space-time. This is the discretized version of it. So the order of Tj is the order of a given triangle, which is the number of force implices to which the triangle belongs. So you can incorporate this by taking take the exponential of the log, so you can promote this to a term in the action, and beta is left as a free parameter in the simulations. Now, the claim in the continuum literature is that beta is not fixed by diffeomorphism invariance. In other words, you know, you can perform a coordinate transformation on this measure term, and you know, it's invariant under that transformation with arbitrary beta. Now, it's also claimed that the canonical formulation, basically once you impose unitarity, then beta is fixed in this formulation. And in fact, you even get a G00, which looks not covariant, but apparently is, because it sort of compensates for there's a Jacobian that compensates for the lack of covariance of the measure. Anyway, this is Fradkin and Vilkovisky and Leutweiler back before he did chiral perturbation theory. This is sort of stuff from the 70s.
These
are formal arguments. Yes. I believe it's perturbation theory. I mean, I think there was a paper suggesting that it held beyond perturbation theory, but I'm not really sure if that's true. There really is a paper. Whether it's, you know, correct or not is another statement. So I guess from my point of view, this local measure term, since you know, this thing is formulated in a coordinate invariant way, so I believe this is my formula is sort of the most general local ultra-local measure term that one can add to the dynamical triangulations. And so I'm just seeing, so if monkeying around with the measure is necessary in some way, then this is sort of the simplest term that's local that one could add to the formulation. At least that's my understanding, but we can discuss that. And so the claim is that you can actually fix beta in these continuum calculations, probably in perturbation theory. So in our simulations, I'm arguing that it can be fine-tuned, that it must be fine-tuned. So let me say this. So I'm revisiting this EDT approach, and I have been revisiting it for a while now, because other formulations suggest that gravity is asymptotically safe. So this is new work done in collaboration with some students, past and present, including a current postdoc at Niels Bohr, Dan Coombe. This is Daping is my postdoc at Syracuse, and there's current and former students. So the idea is maybe a fine tuning is necessary. So we explored this parameter space of dynamical triangulations, including this measure term. And so the question is, well, do we have to add new terms? You know, Jan tried an R squared term some time ago that didn't seem to change things too much. We're trying sort of exploring the phase diagram, trying to be as exhaustive as possible. What's that?
It certainly changed things, but in a very unhealthy way, because the configurations, they froze entirely determined by this R squared term, which wants to put the curvature into zero. But since there is no triangulation of that space, then it was very disastrous. So but this just shows that the formalism one could not implement in that simple way. So the measure term is definitely, in a sense, more flexible, but maybe less concrete.
Yes.
So I guess you could just insist that rather than a measure term, it's a higher curvature term. Because you can expand it to higher curvature.
Isn't that
deep curvature? Well, that might be, but that was how it was viewed originally. And that seems nice. Well, I know you want to go into that, but I'm just saying that one could say that this is just a way to add higher curvature terms. This is different from the new way of doing it. This is singular in the red perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a possibility. I mean, that's right. That's a possibility that one can't rule out, I think, at this point. So yeah, maybe it's an R squared term, maybe it's this measure term. I mean, I'll tell you my story,
but
okay. So I think I'll come back to the slide in a second. So first of all, so we want to simulate this. So how do we do it? So this is fairly standard. So I wrote new code from scratch. So this uses the Metropolis algorithm with a standard set of local update moves. So we did introduce a new algorithm for parallelizing the code, which turns out to be useful when the acceptance is very low. And this was, we called parallel rejection. I don't know if anybody else has used this for anything, but it basically runs multiple streams at once. And then as soon as there's an acceptance, then the streams recombine, do the update, and then start again. So it kind of runs separately and then collapses, runs separately, a bunch of streams. So it turns out that this wasn't very efficient unless we used a shared memory machine. And so it looks like we can only scale roughly, well, given the scale, the shared memory architectures, they don't have that many nodes right now. We got our hands on one that had 10 nodes or 8 nodes, but it looks like we get a sort of 8 or 10 factor speed up over the regular scalar code. And I mean, in Lattice QCD, a factor 10 speed up in real time of your code is good. And we checked that this reproduced the scalar code configuration by configuration, right? I mentioned this algorithm to some of my Lattice colleagues, and they said it doesn't sound like that satisfies detailed balance, but it actually matches exactly the scalar code, and it does satisfy detailed balance and all of these things. So it it's kind of nice. And you know, as scaled memory architectures go up, we can probably, given the kind of low acceptance, we can probably improve. And I don't know, this might be useful for CDT. I mean, but especially if you're in a regime where in the phase diagram where the acceptance might go low. But anyway, so that was sort of a technical thing that we did. So my motivation here, I mean, in other words, why I claim that a fine tuning is necessary. So there's an analogy I want to draw between the phase diagram of EDT with, let's call it the measure term with parameter beta, and then kappa 2, which is basically the inverse G Newton. Okay, so both Jan and collaborators and myself and collaborators found that the EDT phase diagram, actually two somewhat different variants, discretizations of EDT, one that satisfies the combinatorial manifold constraints and another one which weakens them in some way, which is known as degenerate triangulations, which seems to agree, by the way, so they agree, they're known to agree in two dimensions analytically, and the phase diagram looks very similar for these combinatorial and degenerate in EDT.
Well, the beta agree, else we should give up the program.
What's that?
I say, the beta agree, else we should give up the whole program.
Exactly. So they seem to agree. So you've got this branched polymer phase, the collapsed phase, this thing that was dubbed the crinkled region. So you know, you need this non-trivial term here, this beta term, in order to get into this crinkled region. And we saw some things that looked kind of interesting in the crinkled region, but some other things that looked less promising. And so anyway, but after staring at this phase diagram enough, and sort of, you know, in my so-called day job, doing lattice QCD, looking at this phase diagram enough, it sort of clicked that they look kind of the same. And in fact, if but for a historical accident, kappa crit, which is the bare inverse mass of the Wilson fermions, and beta, which is the inverse strong coupling constant, you know, it would be up to labeling almost exactly the same. Anyway, so the point is that in Wilson fermions with a particular discretization of the will of the action, so Wilson fermions, so I don't know how familiar you are with lattice gauge theory and the doubling problem and all of that. I don't know how familiar you guys are with that. I don't know if you can nod or shake your heads. Okay. So the idea here is that, well, so Wilson fermions, so there's this doubling problem. So you just do a naive discretization of the fermion action on the lattice, you get the wrong number of the species of fermions, right? You get extra flavors of fermions. So there are ways to get rid of these doublers. Wilson proposed a particular one, which is to add what has since been called the Wilson term, which basically gives the masses of all the doublers, all of the species except for one, a mass of order the cutoff. And so then you're left with one species of fermion. And basically, there's an extra species for each corner of the hypercube, and you really only want one. So instead of having 16 extra flavors, you know, 15 extra flavors, you get rid of those extra flavors. But this procedure breaks chiral symmetry. Okay, and so in the Wilson fermion formulation, if you wanted to do QCD, say, with massless quarks, you would have to introduce a mass term anyway, because there's a symmetry which is broken by the regulator, which is chiral symmetry. So when you have a symmetry that's broken by your regulator, you have to fine tune in order to restore that symmetry. And so, sorry, I have a bit of a sore throat. So if you wanted to do QCD with massless fermions, you'd have to introduce a bare mass term, which is this kappa, and you'd have to fine-tune it to this first-order phase transition. And you'd have to take beta, which is the inverse coupling, to infinity. So the coupling, of course, goes to zero because QCD is asymptotically free. And so you would just sit as close as possible to this transition line. And if you were away from this transition line, you'd be in some unphysical phase. You wouldn't have, or maybe you could interpret something if you're way out here as being static quarks or something, you know, very heavy quarks, infinite mass quarks. But if you wanted to talk about QCD with close to massless quarks, you'd have to sit very close to this line. It turns out that this line is a first order phase transition, and we know that QCD has a continuum limit, and so there's a second order critical point somewhere out here at beta of beta goes to infinity. So I thought, well, maybe something like that is going on here. We've got this first order line here. Maybe if we skirt close to this line, we can see something that looks a bit more like the physics that we're interested in. And in fact, if you go back to some of the earliest papers on this, the phase or very near the phase transition, that was sort of the only place on the phase diagram where you might believe that the Hausdorff dimension could be close to 4. So, you know, so that seemed like it might be consistent with that story.
But I would say if you have a paper from 95, where we say the Hausdorff dimension is 4, presumably, but we don't dare to present any graph.
Yes, yes.
But you say the word, but that was before we also when we still thought it was a state order transition. So
yes.
At that time, it was an interesting statement.
Yes, yes, that's right, that's right.
But again, I mean, it's just the average, well, I know you present better evidence, but it's just the average between infinite and 2 is clearly false.
Yes, yes. Well, Jan Smit also.
Yeah,
yes.
He's an author, but yeah.
Yes. He even had some plots.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Yes. Yes. No. So it was sort of, and there was a Japanese group, and you know, so there was some. So right. So if you're going to deal with, right, so if you're going to show that you have asymptotic safety, so you know, one of my colleagues asked me, so really what are the problems you would have to overcome with a lattice formulation to really say you have an asymptotically safe theory of gravity? Well, at least these are sort of at a minimum, you have to show the recovery of semi-classical physics in 4 dimensions because you have to get back GR, which has been highly successful. The highly successful classical theory, you know, for which there's a great deal of evidence, and even more so in the last month or so, in the strong field from the LIGO results. Okay, the other thing is you need to show the existence of a continuum limit at a second order critical point. I said that before. Here's a cute little thing, which is just, so there's an argument against the renormalizability of gravity due to Banks. I don't know if you would call this, it's not really a theorem. I'm not sure you'd even call it a folk theorem, but it's, I don't know if you've heard this expression, some of my colleagues use this, sort of things that aren't really very rigorously proved, but sort of people accept, and there's some sort of just some argument that has some things sort of baked into it that are not easily provable, like, you know, what fermions are in the universality class of QCD. Okay, but anyway, so Banks points out that there's a tension between renormalizability and holography. And of course, this relies on semi-classical arguments, which may just be wrong, but I'll just go over the argument. So Banks says that there's basically that asymptotic safety is inconsistent with holography. And what does holography mean other than being sort of the catchphrase of the, well, I don't know, it's sort of a trendy thing to say, but the argument is that if you have a renormalizable theory, then there is a beta function of the theory. The beta function goes to zero, right? The running stops, and so the theory behaves like a scale invariant, a conformally invariant theory at very high energies, right? So at very high energies, you hit the fixed point. The theory behaves like a conformal field theory, and you can do some dimensional analysis and figure out how the entropy scales with energy. Okay, this is just assuming that entropy scales extensively with the spatial volume and also the energy. And so you can, you know, for arbitrary dimension, this is what you get. So this is for a CFT in D dimensions. For gravity, one expects So this is the Banks argument. One expects that the high energy spectrum will be dominated by black holes. Okay, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, I don't know, but you know, that's the argument. And then you have to use the Bekenstein-Hawking area law for how the entropy scales with some region. And there's this analog of how the energy of a black hole scales with its radius for arbitrary dimension, or you just basically analytically continue in the dimension, and you get entropy scaling in this way. And you can plug in d equals 4, and you find that these guys disagree, and then so goes the argument. Therefore, gravity cannot be asymptotically safe. And I think Banks even has a footnote saying something like, therefore, all approaches using dynamical triangulations, asymptotic safety, et cetera, must be incorrect, blah, blah, blah. So anyway. Whatever you want to make of that. So moving on to some data.
It seems to rely on this that you have this new key, which could question what it means for gravity.
Sorry, say again. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
You get the safe key, which usually, I know what the safe key is on a fixed backhaul. But
if you have kind of
it's a bit more
of a question,
it doesn't mean
that it's a key. Yeah, I mean, the argument is just, I think, that if, if it's a renormalizable quantum field theory.
Yeah. But the CFT doesn't, the CFTs you know are not usually fully different.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, which is also usually some argument which comes from a non-perturbative viewpoint on asymptotic safety and what the running actually means, or what momentum scale means in this context. It relates to that. Just that there is a possibility that the standard, that the standard language does not apply, so it's not very clear that gravity has, if it's even if it's a normalizable, it has to be this kind of thing.
I'm going to come back to this, but
I also thought that the people during these transition groups think they have had arguments with you where they tell that they think this is a wrong argument.
That the Banks argument is a wrong argument. Yeah. No, they're. I mean, they come at it. In fact, I gave a talk, and I remember one of the RG people made the statement. There are many reasons why this Banks argument is wrong. And Matthias Neubert, who's in the audience, who's a flavor physicist, QCD sort of big shot in QCD and so forth in Germany. He said, well, so the guy said, there are many reasons why this is wrong. He says, well, you only need one. But yeah, so anyway.
But you could definitely find many.
Yes. Yes. So moving on to lattice data. Okay, so here was our attempt to sit as close to the phase transition as possible. So this is sitting at sort of beta equals zero. So this is without the measure term, or the measure, beta equals zero, sitting on as close as we can to the first order phase transition, approaching it from one side. So the first order phase transition, you have transitions between metastable states. And so we're just probing, analogous to the Wilson QCD simulations, you want to sit in the so-called physical phase, which would be on one side of this first order phase transition, and not count the parts that when it tunnels back and forth, when it tunnels to the other phase, not to count the other phase in the simulations. Okay, so it's in some sense it's taking the limit as you approach the first order phase transition from the left, and so then we want to do finite volume scaling, so we do a few different volumes, and and we see, and we rescale the thing. So we know how this thing should scale if the Hausdorff dimension is 4, right? We know, so what is this correlator? This correlator is basically a shelling of the lattice, right? So there's no structure a priori on the lattice that we really know about beforehand. So we just pick a random point, we walk some a distance one hop away, and then we 2 hops away from that, 3 hops, count the number of simplices, and just keep going until we've counted all the simplices once. And so this is basically, so the x-axis has actually been rescaled, and it's been rescaled assuming that this is a linear dimension, and that this is a volume, a 3 volume. And so basically what I'm saying is I put in Hausdorff dimension 4 into this rescaling, and the curves are pretty close to one another, right? So in other words, this is finite volume scaling with this shows that there's finite volume scaling with Hausdorff dimension close to 4. So that's good. But now then you might also ask, I mean, especially if you're familiar with the CDT literature, what should this curve look like? And it should probably look like, if you want it to match the CDT, you'd like it to look like a 4-sphere. And you know what this function is for a 4-sphere. It's cosine cubed. And cosine cubed is symmetric. Okay, so in this case, there's this long tail here, which people in the literature attribute to baby universes, right? So you have this sort of central cluster of sort of the mother universe, and then you have these long strings of baby universes coming out of it, and that tends to contribute to this long tail. And I have a visualization. Let me just give you a visualization. So here, if you take, so this actually is the plot that I just showed you. So this is a visualization tool of the geometry that I just showed you the profile of. So you can see that there's sort of, you could imagine it's sort of, if it was really just a 4-sphere, this visualization tool, which helps us visualize the internet and networks and so forth, would be basically uniformly filled and would fit in a circle. Or uniformly fill a circle. But what you have is something that maybe sort of uniformly fills a circle with some branches that sort of poke out of it. And these branches here are giving rise to that baby universe tail. Okay, so you can think of these as sort of baby universes branching off of a mother universe. Now, what happens, so it looks like, first of all, when I showed you that phase diagram, I showed you just, I'm sitting at different volumes, but close to a point on that phase transition, right? It moves a little as you vary the volume, but I didn't move along that line, sort of for non-trivial beta. But now I'm going to do some simulations for various values of beta and see what happens. And what happens is, it looks like as I move towards negative beta, this is sort of into the so-called crinkled region, from what people used to call, but sitting as close as possible to this phase transition. What happens is that baby universe tail appears to decrease, right? So it's getting smaller. Now, whether it actually goes to the black line or not, I don't know, but the other thing I should tell you is that there's a measure of sort of the relative lattice spacing. So we can sort of figure out whether the lattices are finer or coarser by measuring some quantity, basically studying the return probability, looking at a diffusion process on the lattices. And what we find is, so these guys are in rainbow order, right, from infrared to ultraviolet. And of course, the ones that are in the ultraviolet are the ones we haven't simulated yet, but they're the ones you can't see. But so it goes from red to blue. So the blue one is the finest one that we were able to produce, and it looks like it's getting closer to the classical solution.
So is it
kappa 2 is not fixed. Kappa 2 is tuned to be close to that first order line.
Okay, so you mean lots of
Yes.
So you're walking out far to the right.
To the far, yes.
So what do you mean is closer and finer?
And
does the lattice constant is fixed,
the geometric one? So the lattice spacing is 1, but if you were to convert it into physical units,
Okay.
Right. So in QCD, you know, you choose beta. Basically, you choose alpha S, and depending on what alpha S is, that fixes the lattice spacing. And so the idea is the same here. You know, you choose your bare parameters, and you know, if you sit on some kind of renormalization group trajectory where things are fixed in physical units, then you know, you could just say that the lattice spacing changes. So here, you know, maybe that's what I'm doing. At the very least, I have some measure of lattice spacing that suggests that the ones in blue here are finer than, say, the ones in red. And in fact, it even matches, sorry, if I go back to this, basically it means I want to sit very close to this blue line and follow things in this direction, which again matches exactly what you do for Wilson fermions, at least with the, you know, with these parameters, this parameterization of the bare action. Okay, so we want to sit here. I've got a few points from up here and down here, sort of getting closer to, you know, taking kappa 2 larger, and beta starts to level out a bit. And so it looks like if there is a continuum limit, it's probably, you know, for large kappa 2.
So I have some comments for this.
Yes.
So of course, this is a lousy fit, so sine cube.
Yeah.
So our work is, of course, this computer power 20 years ago, but also Jens Smith has recently published something. So both Jens Smith and me agree that the first part of this curve is fitting better by an exponential. This is point one. Point two is that, in the old age, we talked about the same transition. I mean, so the exponential chain actually fits as an exponential tail of an excitation which goes to zero at the transition. So to be fitted to a mass scale, simply exponential, this is a two-point correlator, and it fits to an exponential mass. And when you approach the critical kappa 2, this mass scales to zero as the square root of kappa minus kappa 2. And this means that in the continuum, it will scale like e to the minus r divided by square root of g, if you just take that e scaling.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, of course, extremely long away from any attempt to look it as in CDT.
Yes.
Of course, Jens Smith makes a long, sorry, dance, and I don't know how reliable it is, that it's important that it grows exponentially, because that corresponds to, on one side, the transition. He wants to continue on both sides of this.
Yes, that's right.
Whether this is reliable or not, I don't know. Yeah. But he said it's important that it grows exponentially, because that's a cinch, not a sinus cube. So this is curvature. This is space with negative curvature, mm-hmm. and on the other side is space with positive curvature.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very different from your picture.
Yes.
I would say.
Yes.
Well, the curvature seems to me to be a bad fit.
Oh yes. Well, I mean, if you.
Yeah. So, but let me add some more comments now that we are in a friendly environment, so we can play some time.
Yes.
So, if you contribute this long chain to baby universes, which might be reasonable or not, I don't know. But if you do. Then it turns out, then you also know that the so-called three-dimensional spherical shell, as you call it, is completely disconnected. It's not a shell, but it consists of many, it's a completely fractal thing, it consists of many parts. So in this sense, one has to be an optimist to call it a shell and interstitial space. I'm just saying this is how it was used in the old days. But you can try to convince us that you should really use it as a nice shell.
Well,
yeah.
Right. So, I mean, the hope here, of course, you know, sort of independent of how fractal and crazy the geometries look, we want to take some kind of ensemble average. And the hope is, of course, that in the continuum limit and in the large volume limit, that you'll reproduce the correct De Sitter space or Euclidean De Sitter space. Now, whether that no?
Let's have a discussion about this later.
Okay. Yeah.
But the point is it's not fractal, it's disconnected,
mm-hmm.
which is the usual
words. Yeah, I mean, so it would typically be that such a shell So in 2D, you can solve this analytically, and you know that in the continuum limit, it is infinitely disconnected in fractal parts because it's fractal. So here, if baby universes are numerals, it will be disconnected in a similar number of components, at least. So it's not that you have, but again, I mean, as you say, one should of course be a little bit. So what are these pictures? I mean, because these are pictures of
a single configuration
of computer configurations, which are not physical configurations, but at least in CDT, we know it's a connection.
Right. Well, that's right. You're guaranteed not to have these things because they're not there explicitly.
But if you look at one of the spheres, it has exactly the same feature, of course. It's not a three sphere in that case, but it's probably some branch point of
okay. Yeah, I mean, the hope, of course, is that. That to the extent that you have these large a large number of disconnected regions, that's a lattice artifact, right? That these things are sort of order of the lattice. Now, it's possible that you can get things that are actually very large, that have large extents, or basically that are, you can have effects at long separations that are discretization effects, which sounds sort of counterintuitive, except that you get these sorts of things when the lattice regulator breaks a symmetry. So in Wilson fermions, for example, if you try and study the pion sector at fixed lattice spacing, it turns out you can't take the pion mass to zero, even as you try and take the quark masses to zero, because you pick up pion mass becomes proportional to the lattice spacing. And so the pion mass acquires a discretization-dependent lattice spacing. And so you get all kinds of funny behavior if you try to apply your chiral low-energy effective theories. So you end up with actually larger, in many cases, larger discretization effects in the pion sector than in other things like the nucleon sector, or things that would be sort of naively. Yeah, it can get complicated. So it's possible that you have a long distance sort of discretization effect, discretization effect at long distances that goes away as you take the continuum limit. Of course. You can use your imagination here to decide whether this red, whether these curves are really going to approach this line. I mean, the other thing is, I did discuss this with Jan Smit. I mean, he was saying, he likes to fit this region here to an exponential and to show that it's sort of negative curvature. Now, it looks like if you actually change the volume, of course, you probably can't see it on the scale, but as you change the volume, this little bit actually does change a bit. And it's possible that in the large volume continuum limit, this is coming down a bit. So it's possible that, this could be coming down even as this, as you take the infinite volume limit, and this could be coming in. It requires some imagination to see it, and clearly the fit is terrible beyond the peak of this guy to this black curve, because it just doesn't go through the data points.
Still, that is a trick which gives you scaling at this state. So you just speak it exponentially, so the distance from the kappa 2, so you have different curves for different kappas.
Yes.
And then when you close it, scales to zero. So the exponential thing. So that there is a mass there. Mm-hmm. But since it's a first order transition, I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah.
But okay, we should discuss it in private.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the nice thing is that as you follow, this line, it looks like the latent heat of the first order phase transition decreases as you move in this direction. So it's possible that there's a second order endpoint here, or possibly at kappa 2 goes to infinity, but, there could be a second order critical point there. And so we're instructed, or we know from lattice field theory, that if we want to get any sort of universal behavior, that we have to take the continuum limit. And it looks like if there is a second order critical point, it's at the end of that line, not anywhere else. So fortunately, it looks like the thing we're instructed to do is bringing us closer to a CDT-like scenario. Whether you actually get there is, of course, still a matter, an open matter.
So maybe that has, but this has, we should discuss the continuum limit, but But maybe to go on, and then we can discuss how you scale, I should think, for still. I mean, it matters.
Yes, yes.
So do you expect to stop at a final capital or continue like in QCD?
I don't know, I don't know. I mean, I guess that it's more like QCD, but that's just a guess.
Yeah. But then what Renata says is going to be true.
Okay.
We can discuss that later, because okay. Then the capital two large regions going to dominate, and that is brand products. I mean, in the measure term that you add is only logarithmically in whatever corrections, and the kappa 2 into infinity will dominate completely. I think the only hope is it stops at a final kappa 2.
We should discuss that. That's interesting. Right, so one can look at, I don't want to take too much time. So one can look at the spectral dimension. So this is defined via diffusion process. So sigma is just the diffusion time step. So this is just hopping from one simplex to another. P of sigma is the return probability. So it's the probability of being back where you started in a random walk after sigma steps. This is just the definition. So the relative lattice spacing. So we looked at the return probability. So the nice thing about the return probability is that it's relatively insensitive to finite size effects. And for example, at beta equals zero, at multiple lattice, at multiple volumes, if I plot these curves, they lie pretty close to on top of each other. Whereas if I vary beta, then they don't lie very much, very closely on top of each other. But the nice thing is that the x-axis here is a dimensionful quantity, and so I can use that to set a relative lattice spacing. So ideally, what I'd like to do is compute the Planck scale, maybe measure particle interactions or something, and get a Gene Newton to tell me what the Planck scale is at each different lattice spacing, and then use that to set the absolute lattice spacing. But these geometries, to the extent that there this tail in this distribution is a big, is a discretization effect. It's a pretty big discretization effect, and so it's hard. And it's also these volumes are fairly small, so it's hard to make contact with semi-classical physics to really get a Gene Newton. Now, of course, they've. In the CDT program, they have done this by looking at semi-classical fluctuations of the geometries. And I've looked a bit at that. It's a little bit obscured by this baby universe tail. So, to the extent that it goes away in the continuum limit, maybe one could do something similar. For now, I'm just looking at not setting an absolute lattice spacing, but just setting a relative lattice spacing via this return probability, which is relatively insensitive to finite size effects. So then I can rescale these things so that the curves roughly match. Of course, you do have some finite size effects for long sigma, and you expect to have discretization effects at short sigma. So I've tried to optimize the overlap at some intermediate scale, and you can get something that's kind of close. It's at least they match each other to within sort of typical finite size effects. And so this tells me, for example, that the blue lattices are finer than, say, the blue data points, the lattice corresponding to the blue are finer than the ones corresponding to red. Okay, so that's where I'm getting my relative lattice spacing. So sigma.
Because you said it's a dimension.
Right, so sigma, you can look at it in the, so it's related to a distance scale. So this is the number of hops that you take in your diffusion process. If you look at the diffusion equation, it looks like it's a length squared. So you could infer the relative lattice spacing from the factor that you'd need to multiply this by to get the curves to collapse onto a more or less common curve.
But now we need to conclude. So the blue curve is beta equal to 0.8.
Minus 0.8.
Oh, minus 0.8.
Sorry.
Okay.
Yes. I think it's just the PDF.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's just my glasses here.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then you can also look at the spectral dimension. And so it's kind of nice, you know, you see this sort of running spectral dimension, which is similar to what was seen in the CDT, right? So CDT, you have, of course, there you have this very nice extrapolation that goes to 4 at long distances. And then at short distances, well, the question is, what is it? It sort of depends on where you are in the phase diagram. It looks like sort of in the generic, at least from the results of Dan Coombe and Jerzy Jurkiewicz, it looks like that probably it's close to 3/2, at least sort of generically in this extended region, although you know there are some regions where it's also close to 2. So the extrapolation, it's not obvious, right, what the value is. One would, of course, like to take a continuum limit and settle the thing once and for all, you know, sort of with controlled systematics. But at least in these simulations, it looks like it wants to be close to 3/2, which is sort of what it looks like it's close to on the so-called finest lattice spacings that of this result from Coombe and Jurkiewicz. So of course, the fact that you know you can see this thing, it looks like it goes close to 3, and that's sort of, it's very, very hard, and believe me, I tried to use the ansatz of Ambjorn, Jurkiewicz, and Lull that they use to fit the spectral dimension. They have this sort of A plus B divided by C plus sigma, C plus sigma in parentheses, in order to fit this thing. So there isn't really a fit range that one can use that gets you to 4. It looks like this thing wants to be around 3 or so. But I tried, so the green here are different lattice volumes at fixed lattice spacing. This is at the beta equals 0. And you can, again, maybe do an extrapolation of extrapolations. And again, you don't get much above 3.5. So it's kind of hard, although that's getting close to 4. Maybe that's, you know, for some purposes, you know, but then if I go to these coarser couplings, then it actually sort of cuts off, you know, how large the spectral dimension wants to be, rather dramatically. So these are at least in principle two different physical volumes, but they have fairly different lattice spacings. And so if I just assume an A squared type lattice spacing dependence, which maybe one can justify from sort of a Zamancic type argument, you know, Zamancic effective field theory, sort of what powers of A squared appear, you'd expect to appear as discretization effects if you're sort of in the asymptotic regime. Maybe we are, maybe we aren't. But if you just put in an A squared term, you can fit the data. And, you know, that gives you the cyan curve, which sort of takes you to 4. So maybe you can get to 4 at long distances if you could really take the continuum limit and make the lattices big enough. But you can see here that actually making the lattices bigger isn't enough. You would have to go finer. And so I'm hoping that in the regime where this tail goes away, if I can make the lattices big enough, that I'd actually be sitting close to 4 at long distances. Time will tell, right? So I guess I'm just about done. So what's interesting here, I mentioned this Banks argument. What's kind of, I mean, maybe it's a cute fact. If you plug 3/2 into this number, which is, remember, this is the short distance one. If I just play the same game, this basically use the same extrapolation, try and do a continuum infinite volume extrapolation, I get something like this, okay? And if you plug in 3/2 into these formulas, then actually the scaling between the CFT and the GR agrees. Maybe that's an amusing coincidence, I don't know. But CDT sees 3/2 too, at least sort of at the finest lattices that they could simulate by some.
Yeah, so there's something I would like to ask you. So when you look at the arguments of Banks and so on, I mean, they're really using a very kind of, they have a black hole with a radius something, and then a temperature and so on. So it seems to me that all these concepts, they fit much, much better to Hausdorff dimension, if you should choose any dimension. I mean, the spectral dimension is a rather abstract thing, which is not so obvious. But taking volumes correspond to black holes and radius. But the Hausdorff dimension was 4. So why is the spectral dimension bigger than the Hausdorff dimension?
So at least in the CFT theory, I know there are people who put quantum field theories on fractal spacetimes, and they argue, or I think they prove, that the spectral dimension is the thing that you should use. You know, there are all these different fractal dimensions. So if you want to use equations of state scaling, they study things like entropy scaling and energy scaling on fractal spacetimes. So they say for a CFT, it should be this guy. So there's a group in Cambridge who does, they actually do sort of a StatMech. Okay, so I probably don't have too much time to talk about the running of couplings, but we can have the sort of longer version of this. I think I do have to end, so I don't want to take you guys too much time here. But what I would say is, before I conclude, I'd say I sort of have a picture of what symmetry is being broken and sort of how one can understand this. And I study the running of couplings and sort of if this really does define a continuum limit and if you can recover semi-classical gravity in four dimensions, sort of how the running coupling, what the running couplings look like and what the runnings of those couplings and, you know, sort of physical interpretation. But I don't have time for that today. So, but if you actually did have a quantum theory of, you know, that you could, where you could use lattice calculations, you could study things like the running of the cosmological constant in Planck units, at least in principle. So I think I'll conclude there.